Sailor James is a great innovator of the thought of Marx and a revolutionary intellectual who's had a tremendous impact politically and intellectually, theoretically, in the 20th century. He was born in Trinidad in 1901. His father was a schoolteacher friend of the father of George Padmore, whose real name is Malcolm Nurse. So these two elderly gentlemen with their roots in the 19th century produced these two remarkable sons, C.L.R. James and Malcolm Nurse, or George Padmore. And it is said that George Padmore's father had an amazing library of Pan-Africanist and Africanist materials in Trinidad, a British colony, oil-rich British colony in the Caribbean, in the very early days of the 20th century. So C.L.R. James had a remarkably good education in English and French. He was a scholarship boy. He went to the Queen's Royal College, which was set up in Port of Spain, Trinidad, for a kind of sabbatical experience for the dons of Oxford and Cambridge, who had specialized in Latin and literature. So at Queen's Royal College, you had Cambridge and Oxford professors who of language and of literature, and these taught C.L.R. James as a boy, and he then became an instructor in Queen's Royal College, and he's perfectly capable of working in English or in French, and he also has had other languages. And he aspired initially to be a novelist and a short story writer, and indeed he won prizes early on as a short story writer within the British Empire, and had his short story, I believe it was called, I can't remember which of his short stories won the prize. But anyway, he was acclaimed at a very early age. He wrote a novel, and I think the first West Indian novel written by a African West Indian person in 1919, I believe, and it's called Minty Alley. And it's a notable novel because it does celebrate the life of the ordinary people. And the key character is a working class woman, Maisie, who is modeled on the woman that James married in Trinidad, and then she up and left for the United States. And the divorce was organized later, but she went off because she wanted to take advantage of the opportunities that were there, following many, many thousands of people from the Caribbean to Europe and to North America after World War I. I might say also that he was a striking person physically, very tall, 6'4", and initially a champion at the long jump and subsequently at cricket. And he went to England in 1933 at the age of 32 and stayed with Leary Constantine, a Trinidadian cricketer who had risen to the top of league cricket in Britain, and lived in Lancashire, and C.L.R. James lived with Leary and his wife, and wrote, co-authored with Leary Constantine, a biography, or autobiography, really, of Leary Constantine, and got a job as the Manchester Guardian cricket correspondent. And this was his bread and butter, and it was also a way that he could politicize people in the colonies, the British colonies, who were quite adept at beating their colonial masters on the cricket pitch, and I might say the soccer field, where the opportunity presented itself, but were still very much under the political and economic yoke of British colonialism and imperialism. And so C.L.R. James used this avenue in the 30s to address the colonial question and to argue, as he continued to do throughout his life, that the expropriated, the dispossessed, those objects of racism and sexism and class discrimination were in fact the sources of great culture, great athletics, great music, great theory. This was his conviction. And he articulated that in many, many ways. He was known in the 30s as Britain's leading Trotskyist. He was a member of the Trotskyist Party. He was a member, he was the editor of the Left Labour Bulletin. He was writing constantly. He was educating people in all sorts of workshops, in rooms above pubs, in the old workingmen's association kind of organizational format, and indeed with the same clientele or the same social class, that is, working class British people, and increasingly immigrants and people who were political exiles from the colonies, people from Asia, people from Africa and the Caribbean. So a very mixed group of people. And this culminated in his participating in 1945 in the Fifth Pan-African Congress in Manchester, or was it Liverpool?
Manchester.
Which heralded the independence movements for the British colonies and laid down exactly what the program would be for independence for the colonial peoples. I must mention, too, his work in the mid-30s. In 1935, he wrote a play for his close friend Paul Robeson, a famous football player, singer, communist, and African-American actor on the stage and in the early movies. And this play is called Black Jacobins. It's about the second successful revolution to establish a republic in the New World or the Western Hemisphere. In 1791, the people of San Domingo, one-third, all of whom were slaves and one-third of whom were actually born in Africa, overthrew the French colonial and slaveocracy and successfully established a republic very shortly after the First Republic, that is, the United States, was established by expelling the British. And this play was written specifically for Robeson. Robeson played, of course, Toussaint Louverture, and it didn't do particularly well. It was put on in London, in the West End, in the theatre district, but out of it grew a very important book, Black Jacobins, which James wrote in the introduction, was intended for the young people of the colonies who were starting to move towards building an independence movement in order to establish their own countries free from British direct political rule. And why did James think that this would be useful for especially young West Indians and Africans and people from Asia, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Sri Lanka? Well, because in the Haitian Revolution or the Revolution of San Domingo in the 1790s, we see people who are thought to be at the very bottom of society, the most disempowered, and indeed the racism of the time, which was virulent, scientific racism, was becoming a force in the 1780s and 1790s. Indeed, the idea of the racist idea of people who are non-European actually being inferior, biologically and physically, some subhuman species, only arose in the 1730s. 1730 to 1760 was the period during which racism as a subhuman designation, less than the European humanity, took hold. Before that, we didn't have it. We had all people were human. So people of San Domingo, in standing up to this kind of racist conception and standing up to slaveholders and the planters, the merchants, the mercantile and now rising industrial bourgeoisie, and especially standing up to the huge marine forces of the French, that is, Napoleon's fleets, to stand up and to be victorious was a tremendous achievement. And in fact, it required a reconfiguration in people's understanding of the nature of Caribbean people and of colonized people and of enslaved people. And what James did with his understanding, his theoretical understanding of Marx and Trotsky and Lenin, what James did was to say that embodied in the person of the Caribbean slave were the most modern social forces, the most modern ideas, the most internationalist and universalist conceptions of organization that history had hitherto produced. Why was that? Well, James pointed out that before there was a European proletariat, you had agro-industrial production in the large sugar plantations, whereby, as he would point out, 5 years after a railroad was first established in Britain, a railroad was established in Trinidad. Why? Because the modern production of sugar required the transportation of the cane quickly from the field to the factory. So you had gangs of slaves, sometimes only 30, but up to 3,000, 4,000, people working in concert in the most sophisticated technology of the time, and these being a node in an international system of production, distribution, exchange and consumption, such that, for example, the salt cod from Newfoundland, Nova Scotia, and the West Bank was a staple food of the slaves who were not allowed to relieve themselves of this intense labor long enough to actually fish and produce their own protein. And gradually, especially female slaves, did negotiate time from the slave master to produce in their gardens. And there's a very important book by Mary Turner that's arguing now, an edited collection by Mary Turner, arguing now that it was the women who were negotiating more and more and more time for their own gardens and for their own marketing operations that at a certain point were able to say to the slave owner, well, I'm sorry, we're not going to give you food. You're dependent now upon us for food, and we're denying it to you until we can get more advantages. And this was crucial to the local movements of the enslaved to abolish slavery. So James's work on the Haitian Revolution was very instructive for people who in the colonies had, as Frantz Fanon pointed out very well in Wretched of the Earth and many of his other books, had incorporated into their own personalities a sense of human inferiority, a sense of historylessness, a negative self-conception. James blew that sky high with Black Jacobin. The Caribbean was a crossroads, and James pointed out that the people of the Caribbean had a special sociological quality, which in fact is not seen elsewhere, which is that they were transported forcibly from their indigenous cultures. So there was a tremendous divide between the enslaved, the captive, and the societies from which they came. Their languages were prohibited. Their social patterns, their celebrations, their music, their cultural expression was criminalized and pushed underground. And the only way that they could communicate with each other was in the slaveholders' language, which were the modern languages of, well, the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, that is Portuguese and Spanish, and then French and English. And so the French Revolution, the literature of the French Revolution, 6 weeks after it was published in France, or comparable literature from the American Revolution, the insurgency in the United States, or in Britain, was very quickly in the hands of captives in the Caribbean. They were able to contribute to this literature. Indeed, there was a circulation of not just of ideas, but of people. Because when captives defended one side or another of a European conflict, they were often promised, and their motivation for joining one side or the other would be emancipation. And when they were emancipated, they were often returned to Africa, especially Sierra Leone, Liberia are examples of this, or they were dumped on another Caribbean island. And this circulation of struggle, they were also taken to the UK, or many of them would sign on or would be captured and impressed onto ships, both merchant and military, and so they would be in Europe. So there was a huge circulation of African people and ideas about Revolution ideas about the international character of struggle. And so James realized this, and he said that the Caribbean people are special not just because they've been cut off from what Marx called the debilitating, the backward, the pre-capitalist social relations of superstition and all kinds of calumny he cast upon, and perhaps unfairly, the social organizations of the pre-capitalist African societies. Not only were they cut off from their roots in that sense and thrust into a very modern milieu, most markedly the modern milieu of the first factory, that is the ship, and the second factory, that is the slave plantation, the agro-industrial sugar and tobacco and cotton plantations, but also that in the Caribbean, African people have very little opportunity to express their creativity due to the continuing character of colonialism and imperialism at a time when these small islands were just one link in an international chain. So this combination of having internalized all that was sophisticated, modern, and best, and yet being unable to express itself locally, forced the Caribbean people into the world stage, onto the world stage, and into the international arena, and there they accomplished wonders in all fields.
So what was it about James's personality or about the way that he was, it would seem that he was educated in a fashion that was very much in the sort of old school colonial system, and that he was coming from a middle class background, and what led him to break from that tradition or that mode of intellectual thought and embrace communist ideology or to join a communist group in the 30s, and why would he do that as opposed to existing within a relatively comfortable position within Trinidadian society?
I think there's two kind of lines of answer to that important question. Why did James, what radicalized C.L.R. James? One was his recognition that on the cricket pitch, it was the black, that is not brown-skinned or white, but black cricketers who were the best. He himself was in a cricket team in Trinidad that was mulatto, mixed white and African, mixed European and African. But he saw that the Africans were the great batsmen and the great bowlers, and this impressed him very much. And when he went to Britain, he also saw that the lie was put to racism by the athletic prowess of non-European peoples. So he had firmly in his mind not only that the lowest of the low were better than their masters, but that they were being, that this quality of achievement was being repressed and suppressed through racism and, as he came to understand, through capitalist relations. And then the second force that radicalized James was the Afro-Caribbean working class woman, in particular Maisie. I mentioned this main character in his first novel, the first novel in Caribbean, African Caribbean literature. This was a person who had joie de vivre, who was creative, who could make ends meet, who could make people laugh, who could enjoy herself, who was free, who was brazen, who was the opposite of the kind of middle-class white European, passive, male-serving, self-deprecating construction of Victorian womanhood. And James was most impressed by this kind of woman. And he saw that this was an African woman, and these were Caribbean women. And he was—he realized that the production of life itself was in the hands of such people. And he married such a woman, and he continued to admire and try to understand where this energy was coming from. And he happened to read Trotsky. One of the first books he read, somehow it came into his hands, Trotsky's, I'm not sure if it was Trotsky's autobiography or his History of the Russian Revolution. But one of Trotsky, I believe it was the History of the Russian Revolution, came into his hands early on. He said he then read Trotsky beginning to end and then started to read Marx.
And this is a period, too, I guess, of overwhelming economic collapse. across the world, and also in the situation of the Italians invading Ethiopia or Abyssinia, which must have also been an impact in terms of his early.
Well, he was part of that left movement in, of course, he was not just in England, in Britain, he was going to France frequently. The French archives, of course, would have the material that he would use to write his history of the San Domingo Revolution. So he was very aware that in the capacity to stop the Italian fascists lay in fascist invasion of Ethiopia in 1934-35, that the capacity to stop this invasion lay in the hands of the European working class. And he argued vehemently in the Independent Labor Bulletin and elsewhere that an oil embargo against Italy would throttle the Italian war effort in Africa. And this he posited as an alternative to the very weak-kneed and, in fact, merely rhetorical League of Nations proposal for an embargo against Italy. The governments of the world organized in the League of Nations did very little to stop Mussolini's encroachment into North Africa and as far as Addis Ababa. And so James and others worked to organize an oil embargo against Italy, which had some effect, but as we know, I mean, Mussolini was not stopped till much later.
And then what led to James moving to the United States and taking up political work there?
Initially, his move to the United States in 1939 was a temporary speaking tour, and then with the outbreak of the war, it became very difficult for him to come back to Europe, and it was thought by people he was associated with politically that it would be much better for James to, first of all, to work with Trotsky in Mexico City and to tour the south of the United States, given that James was African and very dark-skinned, that he could easily move in the sharecropping circles, the urban poor communities, Harlem, the black ghettos of Chicago and Detroit and San Francisco and Los Angeles, and do political work amongst African Caribbean and African American people, and he did so. And I might mention also that he at that time fell in love with Constance Webb, who was 19 years old and was a strikingly beautiful European American woman who was involved in movies, early movies, and the stage in Hollywood. And she is notable for being the first billboard model. A strikingly beautiful woman who wrote poetry, was quite accomplished, and James was in love with her, and this is another force that kept him in North America.
And what sort of political evolution did he undergo when in the United States? Were there contributions in specific that he made to the socialist movement there, and what were the kinds of conflicts that he had with the existing Trotskyist party that he was a part of?
Well, he broke with Trotsky after a debate in 39, and the materials are published, on two main points. One, the nature of the revolutionary organization. James believed that it should not be a disciplined party, but rather that his... James believed very much, as Marx argued, that the working class and revolutionary forces are organized, united, and disciplined by the very mechanism of capitalist production, exchange, and consumption itself. And that this organizational force was, James argued, what was pushing the most radical elements, was bringing together and giving the capacity to effect change for the most radical elements, not just in the Caribbean, not just in Europe or in Africa, but most particularly amongst black people in the United States. And he saw lots of links between white and black and lots of betrayals of those links as well. The second reason he broke with Trotsky had to do with the black question, so-called. At that time, Trotsky's position was that the southern states had a large enough African-American population to allow them to constitute themselves as a separate nation. So a secessionist African-American state was very much in Trotsky's mind. James said that independence for the Caribbean communities, the colonies of the Caribbean, which were majority African, was obvious. This would be this kind of nation state or nationalism was the political strategy of victory and of righteousness for the British colonies and the French colonies. But in the United States, he said this was nonsense, that there was the idea of secession or separatism was nonsense, that in fact, African Americans, in many of the struggles that were going on in the 30s and 40s in the United States, were at the forefront of those struggles, that there was a significant unity between black and white, exploited and dispossessed and struggling people, and that there was no real basis in any sense for separatism in a black nation within the United States.
Was it after his break with Trotsky that he also broke with the Socialist Workers' Party on the question of the Soviet Union?
James was never of the view that the Soviet Union was a revolutionary society or had the potential to be a socialist progressive revolutionary society. He always viewed it as a state capitalist society.
From its beginning or after its degeneration under Stalin?
After its degeneration and from the last three or four documents, that last three documents that Lenin penned in 1923, just before his death, James always referred to those documents as evidence that Lenin, too, recognized that what was happening in the Soviet Union was a reworking of Tsarist totalitarianism using the Tsar's administrative bureaucracy for repression, and that Stalin was just riding that repressive apparatus. And of course, James did associate himself with the recommendations that Lenin brought in at that time, which were to do with a very radical democratization of the society based on elected committees outside unions and outside the party, and based on an idea of education for democracy at every level. He said that Lenin said, and James repeated constantly, that the duty of the revolutionary was to educate in the home, in the community, and at the place of work, to educate in actually running democratically our domestic and social and community and productive lives. And this is the kind of recommendation that James gave to African revolutionaries and to Nyerere for the Arusha Declaration in 67, for example, to Nkrumah. Throughout the anti-colonial work, this was the text, the late Leninist perceptions. So James, you see, was one of the lodestones of his creativity and power. He was one of the only, perhaps the most prominent, creative thinker who was not developing a critique of Stalinism. He was based on originally being a Stalinist or being a person who had been politicized and came to a theoretical understanding of social struggle inside and in some sense subordinate to or an adherent of the Russian experiment. James was very interested in the revolutionary potential of the Russian commune, the rural commune, for example. And he always drew attention to Marx's writings on the commune.
James, after the Second World War period, also worked with people like Marty Glaberman and Grace Lee Boggs and Raya Dunayevskaya. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate on some of the, you know, what that sort of theoretical interchange was like and where that led.
Well, the people that you mentioned, especially Grace Lee Boggs and Raya Dunayevskaya, are European and Asian people with tremendous linguistic capabilities. They, amongst themselves, could read Russian and German and Italian and Spanish and French and English. So in the 40s, they were part of a tremendous struggle for the hearts and minds of the left globally. And the avenue that this struggle took was to de-Stalinize the translations of Marx and Lenin to a lesser extent, but Marx. So they took the original texts and they gave them an honest translation. And as you can imagine, Stalin and his hacks had hacked up Marx for their own ends. So their mission was to present Marx as indeed Marx presented himself. And for example, they translated for the they were the first people to translate the 1844 manuscripts, where you see a humanist emphasis, an emphasis where Marx is writing about human alienation and the need to overcome private property and the exploitation of the dispossessed as a means to becoming truly human and developing a universalist conception of all people being equal and all people being entitled to respect, basic livelihood, entitlements, and so on. And so this was a tremendous breakthrough at a time when the right, when capital was increasingly concerned in the 30s and 40s, increasingly concerned about the insurgency of a working class globally and a colonized people globally who realized in the depression, the global depression of the 1930s, that another world was possible and had to, in fact, construct this alternative world as a means of survival, and who, in order to be induced into war and quieted after the war, people who felt that they were entitled to and did indeed demand social programs and great concessions from capital via the Keynesianism of the welfare state throughout the world. So in this milieu, James and Raya Dunyevskaya, Gracie Boggs, Marty Gleiberman, and a number of other people, Redeker, other people younger, who only came to public awareness and who began to write in the 60s and 70s, James had a tremendous influence and was indeed influenced by these people. What you see there, too, is amongst this group of people who are now based largely in... They were called the Johnson-Forrest Tendency. Johnson was James and Forrest was Dunyevskaya. They published a huge amount of material in the 50s, the 40s and 50s, a huge amount. Wonderful material, very exciting material, centralizing in particular the ideas I mentioned before about that we're united, organized, and disciplined by the process of production, exchange, and consumption itself, and that as capital becomes more and more and more concentrated, this organization, unity, and discipline becomes more and more and more sophisticated, globalized, and empowering to the dispossessed. In other words, capitalism digs its own grave, and this is the shape that the grave digging and overcoming and transformational energies take. But also, they were amongst them male and female, black and white, Asian, African, and European. They were reaching many, many, many constituencies, not just in the United States, but globally. They're also white male, European male, in Marty Gleiberman. They were involved in educating the Detroit auto workers. They recognized the importance of a new social form, which you could say is more advanced, more sophisticated than the actual Soviet as a social form of revolution and self-government and communist.
What did they see that form as being?
The workers' committee. The shop floor committee, which emerged in the 50s, all over the industrialized world. And there's another important dimension that we can't neglect here. In the late 40s, right as soon as the Second World War was over in 1945, the United States, as we know through especially Kanan and other ideologues of U.S. foreign policy, made the Soviet Union a bête noire. The great enemy of the United States became its former ally, the Soviet Union became its greatest enemy. And we have the development of McCarthyism and the closing of the American mind to the world, to social analysis, to history, the criminalization of professors and anybody else who used words such as class or contradiction or alienation or exploitation, a whole raping of the language and of the education system and of public speech and public thought, such that in the United States today you have a very, very seriously underdeveloped population in terms of education and understanding. You have several generations of this. Well, as this was building up in the 40s, James broke with Constance Webb, his wife, with whom he had one child, known as Nobby, developed a relationship with Selma James, who he later married. And Selma James was a working class girl from Brooklyn, Jewish, who in the early 50s was very important in promoting feminist theoretical extensions of Marxist thought. And James was very, 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 very interested in this and supported it and in every way tried to incorporate it into his own thought. So that what we have here, the leap we have in terms, and James always said, we're extending Marxism, we're extending Marx, we're not countering or denying or saying, ah, Marx was wrong, I am right, therefore don't read Marx, just read me. It was none of that nonsense. We see that today in a lot of places, unfortunately. He was extending Marx with his work on the African struggle and the anti-colonial struggle, Black Jacobins, to include unwaged workers and people who were non-European. And he was saying that the first great revolutionaries were, in fact, African slaves. And then he was extending Marx again, along with Selma James and Raya Dunyevskaya and many other people at that time, by including women, again, unwaged and not people who, as Stalin and others argued, even Engels argued, could only be free if they became waged and joined with other waged workers in a union to overthrow or challenge the boss at work and politicized that challenge and took over the state and then considered the question of women's rights or anti-racist questions. James and his people undercut all of that and said, directly from dispossession, the status of being dispossessed, women, African people, unwaged people, peasants, urban youth, beatniks, Rastafari, Mau Mau. He actually specified all these groups in the 50s. The Kenyan Mau Mau movement was strong at that time in capturing the world's imagination. That all of these elements could directly make revolution. They were directly exploited and they were directly repudiating that exploitation and joining together as elements of a multitude of the dispossessed to transform relationships of exploitation and allow a regeneration, a rebirth, a reinvention of, a retaking of the commons. His concept of communism was always, as was Marx's, a return to the pre-capitalist social relations of a moral economy, reciprocity between men and women, pleasure, joy, happiness, plenty, leisure, the abolition of work as exploitation, the abolition of much of the division of labor, such that, as Marx said, you can read a book in the morning, go fishing in the afternoon, and be a critic at night. You can do many things with your life. This idea of the total human being. So James was with the feminists, with the anti-colonialists, with the African insurgents. He was the harbinger of this kind of social analysis, this kind of bottom-up perception of history and of the future. And as such was tremendously loved, tremendously popular, had a tremendously immediate impact on generations of revolutionary intellectuals.